I don't know how to even really say it, that your willingness to put other things aside and to continue to be with God's people, no matter how many are assembled, to be with God's people and to spend time in prayer, spend time in song, spend time with the Holy Scriptures opened. It's greatly appreciated. And not just by me, but our God who's looking down upon us. It's appreciated by Him. I know that that's the case. I'm confident that's the case. That's what's revealed in Scripture. So we're going to spend just a few minutes tonight. We won't be as normally long-winded as we normally are, something like that. But we will spend some time considering this topic that we've been looking at the last couple of weeks about seeing Jesus in the Old Testament. Jesus on every page, as we're calling it. Last time we were together, last Sunday night, we considered Joseph and Jesus. We spent a lot of time focusing on Joseph as we find his historical account. Be turning in your Bibles to Genesis. The story of Joseph is told from Genesis 37 through Genesis 50. And we spent a lot of time last week considering the way that when we see what Joseph went through and then compare that to the life of Jesus, we see that the things that really and truly happened in the history of the world, that in real time, that actually happened to Joseph, we can now reflect back upon and see how that was preparing us and helping us, readying the people for Jesus, and thus helping us to be able to study and understand, to be prepared for Jesus. So tonight what we're going to do, we're still going to be in that same text, Genesis 37 through 50, but tonight we're going to add an extra character, if you will. Tonight we focus on Joseph, Judah, and Jesus. And so when we say Joseph, Judah, and Jesus, we're not talking about the tribe of Judah. We're not talking about the people, the clan of Judah. We're talking about the man, Judah. So if you go ahead and go to that next slide there, and you'll see Joseph, Judah, and Jesus based upon Genesis 37 through 50. And so we're going to switch it just a little bit and consider the things that happen between, exclusively happening between Joseph and Judah, these two brothers. And then the way that our focus is going to be on Judah himself and seeing from him, rather than highlighting Joseph and Jesus, we'll highlight Judah and Jesus this time. And I think that if you haven't thought about it this before, thought about it this way before, I think you'll be very impressed at the way Judah was a marker and a symbol of Jesus and getting us ready for Jesus and helping you and me now be able to better understand Jesus. I think if we began at the end, if you turned in your Bibles to Genesis 49, because you know Genesis 49 is the end, there's only 50 chapters in Genesis. If we begin at the end, and in Genesis 49, here's what's happening. He'll give you context of Genesis 49. Here's what's happening. Jacob is getting ready to die. You know the great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob. Jacob's the one whose name is changed by God to Israel. He's going to be the father of the 12 tribes, right? And blessings are so important. And if anyone knows that, it's Jacob. Because remember, Jacob's the one that outmaneuvered his brother, Jacob and Esau. He outmaneuvered Esau in order to get the special blessings. Because he's younger. And so he outmaneuvers his brother Esau in order to get the special blessings from his father Isaac. Isaac blesses Jacob. Jacob goes on to be the great patriarch. So here, Jacob's at the end of his life. And he's going to bless his 12 sons. Now, based upon what we'd read, Genesis 37 through 49, we'd think the most wonderful blessing is going to be reserved for one of two people. Now, as the way it normally happens in those ancient times, it should be given to Reuben, right? Because Reuben's the firstborn. Well, it's not going to be Reuben. So it should be Joseph. Joseph's the one who's been talked about through all of this. Joseph's the special one. Joseph's the one that's been highlighted. He's the great one. He's the faithful one. He's the godly one. Not going to be Joseph. If you look with me in Genesis 49, we begin reading at verse 8, it's Judah that's going to get the great blessing. Genesis 49, verse 8. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Now remember what had happened so long ago, way back in 37. Joseph had those dreams that all his 12 brothers would fall down in front of him. Now that does eventually happen in Egypt. They do all fall down in front of him. But the message from Jacob to Judah is, your brothers will praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you've gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion, as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He's washed his garments in wine, and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. The greatest blessing is reserved for Judah. To Judah, he says, others will bow down before you. To Judah, he says, from this point forward, you'll be the one in the place of prominence. You'll be the one in the position of being blessed. All others will look to you, and it's through your family that kings will come. The scepter will not be moved. You know, that's symbolic of being a king. The kings will stay with you in your family. He gets the blessing. So if we started at the end, if we started at Genesis 49, we would think if we went back, that then moving forward, that what we would see is that Judah is the great one, right? But that's not at all what we see. It seems strange, knowing what we know about Joseph. Just real quickly, maybe keep your hand in Genesis. Flip over to Matthew chapter 1. And in Matthew 1, this is where we have the genealogy of Jesus given. I want you to see the way it begins. Matthew 1:1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And here's how it goes. Abraham's the father of Isaac. Isaac's the father of Jacob, and Jacob is the father of, shouldn't that be Joseph next? Jacob's the father of Joseph. He's the great one. He's the one that was in charge of all of Egypt. But it says, no, Jacob was the father of Judah, and then get this, and his brothers. Judah and his brothers, rather than Joseph and his brothers. Judah and his brothers. And Judah was the father of Perez, and it goes on through there, and leads up to Jesse and David, and then eventually to the Christ. So looking at this, we see that Judah is the hero. Judah is the one honored even above his brother Joseph. Now let me just tell you, that's a puzzling choice in some respects. Judah, as you go back to Genesis 37 and move forward, we're going to see in so many different ways, Judah is the villain. And really, aren't chapters 37 through 50 of Genesis about Joseph? They're not about Judah, they're about Joseph. But Judah's the one that's held up. Judah's the one that's esteemed. It's him and his brothers. So what I want us to do is just very quickly, we're going to name five things, five very negative things about Judah that sort of make us scratch our heads as to think, why is he the one getting the praise? Why is he the one mentioned in Matthew chapter 1? Why is the kingdom, the king, going to come from him rather than someone else? So five negative things, but then five amazingly positive things that will help us understand Jesus better after that. So let's quickly run through these five negative things about Judah. Number one, Judah is a very jealous man. Right along with all of his other brothers, look at Genesis 37. It says flat out in verses 3 through 5, and then down in verse 8, it says they hated him for his dreams. They hate Joseph. His brothers hate him. Then down in verse 11 of Genesis 37, it says his brothers were jealous of him. They're jealous. They hate that his father, that their father, loves him and treats him special above them. They hate him. They hate the dreams that he has. They hate the attitude that he has. They hate everything about him, and they're jealous of him. And he is right along with that. Judah, as we're going to see, is a ringleader in this jealousy. Secondly, he's also vindictive. And by that, I mean he's a violent man that's going to be the leader in trying to hurt Joseph. Look at chapter 37, beginning at verse 19. They said, here comes that dreamer. Remember when Joseph is looking for his brothers. They say, come now, let us kill him. Throw him in one of the pits, and we'll say that an animal devoured him. And we'll see what becomes of his dreams. Then, Reuben, the firstborn, the one who should be the leader, he hears it and rescues him out of their hands. And let's not take his life. Let's shed no blood. But drop to verse 26. And notice who is the leader here. Okay, verse 26, Judah says to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother, our own flesh. And look at this, this is an important phrase, and his brothers listen to him. Judah is the ringleader in being vindictive. Let's get rid of him, and let's make a little money on the side. It's a win-win situation. Our headache goes away, and we get some money. It's perfect. And all the other brothers listen. He's not the oldest. He's the fourth born. No one should be listening to him in this ancient setting. But he's the leader, and he's the one that says, let's get rid of him. Thirdly, we see in a negative light, he's also a liar. He, right here in this same chapter, verses 31 and 32, he's right in part with where they know they've got the coat, and they dip it in the blood, and they bring it to their father, to Jacob, and they say, tell us, is this your son's coat? Knowing that it's not, that it is, and that he's alive. And they have to, they sit there and watch their father in agony and in tears and in pain. They flat out lie to him, saying, clearly your son has been devoured, right? Number four and number five are the two worst, really, if those aren't bad enough. Number four, he is clearly, at a point in time in his life, he's immoral. You go to chapter 38, drop down to about verse 12, and we see that his wife has passed away, the mother of all of his children. But we see down at verse 12, it says, in the course of time, his wife, Shua's daughter, died. When he was finally comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, sat at the entrance. And verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Tamar dressed up like a prostitute. He sees her, and he goes in. Clearly, living an immoral lifestyle. Clearly one who is, at this point, not able to stand up to much of any kind of temptation. He's walking through a city, sees a temptation, and immediately gives in. Compare him just one chapter over to his brother, his younger brother Joseph, who in Genesis 39, again and again and again, is begged and pleaded by Potiphar's wife to give in. And he refuses again and again. And see, these two stories are put side by side. Here's Judah, chapter 38, easily gives in to immoral temptation. Here's Joseph, chapter 39, refuses to give in to that temptation, refuses to dishonor God. And they're put side by side to highlight one another. Here's how deeply one has fallen, and here's how one remains high. Then number four, we see that he's also a hypocrite. Judah is a jealous, vindictive, lying, immoral hypocrite at this point. Because what happens is that when Tamar is found to be pregnant, they come before Judah, this man that's in a position of power, and they say, look at 38:24. It says, about 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she's pregnant by this immorality. Look what he says. Bring her out and let her be burned. How dare she think she can get away with being immoral? We'll teach her. We don't have any immorality in this house. Bring her out and we'll burn her. He's a hypocrite. I mean, he was just engaged in that very act himself just those few months ago. How can it be that this one is chosen above his brothers? How can it be that this one, that this guy with this list in front of you, how could this Judah be chosen as the one through whom the king, and I don't just mean David, right? Through that we mean the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, Jesus the Christ, would come through this family. That's what that blessing in Genesis 49 meant. Through you, the king will come. The Messiah will come. The language there, don't you see the language about the donkey being tied up to the vine? What did Jesus ride in to the city to prove, to fulfill Scripture that he was the coming Messiah? Rode in on a donkey. This is the family. This is the man that the king, not just David, but the King Jesus would come through. How can it be? Well, let's list five things that sort of, on the other side of the coin, of these five negative things, let's list five positive things. And here's number one. He was finally willing to admit his sin. He was finally willing to admit it. Look at 38:26. You know, they bring Tamar in. He says, burn her. We don't have that immorality going on in our home. Will you burn her? And so Tamar sends message. Look at 25. It says, she was being brought out. She sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these things belong. Remember, she kept the tokens that proved that it was him. She said, the person that these things belong to, he's the one that got me pregnant. And so, verse 26, Judah identified them, and look at what he said. she's more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah, and he did not know her again. She's more righteous than I. He recognized the saying there is, I am a terrible sinner. That's what he's saying. He finally realized, because he's not whitewashing and saying it's okay that what she did, to dress up in the way she did and to deceive him the way she did. He's not saying that was okay. He's saying what he did was so much worse. He's taking recognition, taking ownership of his sin. Doesn't this sound to you just like David, the man after God's own heart, when in 2 Samuel chapter 12, when he had brought Bathsheba into his home, had murdered her husband, when Nathan the prophet finally said, you are the man, what did he do? He said, I've sinned against God. I've sinned against God. And so one of the ways that we can see that Judah, see, David called a man after God's own heart. David went through and did some of the most wicked things you could ever imagine, adultery and murder, but he's called a man after God's own heart. Here, Judah is the same kind of man, done all these terrible things, fit that list we just put up. But when his sin is shown to him, he realizes it. She's more righteous than me. I'm a terrible sinner, he's saying. He's willing to admit his sin and to be like David, to be like the man after God's own heart. This is where we see Judah, just like David, seemingly starting to turn it around. Because we know that we have a God of second chances. We have a God of the turnaround, and how thankful we should be for that. Secondly, he recognizes that the power belongs to God, not to some man. Go with me to chapter 44 this time. And we got to fast forward in history numerous years. And recall here that what's happened is Joseph has gone to Egypt, become the second most powerful man in all of Egypt, just to Pharaoh himself. There's a famine in the land. Remember, God had told him in the vision, 7 years of plenty, so store up lots of food because there's coming 7 years of famine. Here we are within about 2 years worth of the famine, and Joseph's family back home is going destitute. So they've got nothing to eat. So these brothers have to keep coming to Joseph for their food, but they don't know it's Joseph. Well, Joseph is going to, through a series of tests, set his brothers up. And one of the things that he does, and we'll talk about this more in just a moment, is he puts a silver cup into Benjamin's bag. And I want you to read with me Genesis 44. Look at verse 5. And notice where the Bible emphasizes that the Egyptians are giving the praise, if you will. Verse 5. Is it not from this? You can just consider them holding that cup. Is it not from this cup that my Lord drinks, and by this he practices divination? You've done evil by doing this. In other words, what they're saying is this cup is a special cup that he uses to do magic. Maybe you can kind of equate in your mind, it's like a crystal ball or some kind of a thing where that he's using to trick people in to thinking he uses this to see the future. He uses this item to be able to understand the right ways of the world. Verse 15 says the same thing. He's going to say it himself. Joseph says to them, what deed is this that you've done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination? I use this cup to divine things. It's my crystal ball. But here's the key. Even though two different times one of the minions of Joseph has said it and Joseph himself has said it, I use this to practice magic. Notice Judah's answer. This is pretty powerful. He says in verse 16, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How can we clear ourselves? Notice he does not say here next, your magic has found out. He says, God has found out the guilt of your servants. In other words, he says, I don't care what you say. I know we're in this position because God has put us in this position. I don't care what you say. I don't care what the magician from Egypt say. I know God's the one with power. I know God's the one who's pulled back the curtain here. God is the one who's done this. God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we're my Lord's servants, both we and he also in whose hand the cup has been found. He said, I know that God did this. I know you can't do it. I know God did it. Now, I want you to be able to compare this to, go back in Genesis 41 to verse 16, Genesis 41, 16, and compare Judah's answer now. Remember, this is the new Judah. This is the turned around Judah and the way he sounds like Joseph from before. We're in Genesis chapter 41 where Pharaoh has that dream and no one in his kingdom can answer the dream. No one can tell him the dream. And Joseph's brought before him, and Pharaoh says, so can you do this? 41:16, he says, no, I can't do it. God can. I can't give you the answer, but God can. You see, Judah now has moved to that point where he's just like Joseph was. And he says, I know you don't have any answers, but I know God has the answers. I know you can't do this, but I know God can do this. He recognizes God has the power. And number three, he's a man who deeply loves his father. And he's a man that cannot bear the thought of seeing his father hurt. He's a man who cannot bear the idea of his father hurting at all. In Genesis 44 here, look at verse 18. Judah goes up to him and says, "My Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ear. Let not your anger burn against your servant, for you're like Pharaoh himself." He's going to launch into this long story, retelling the idea of who we are and where we've come from and why we can't let you hurt Benjamin. Go down to verse 30. "Therefore, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us." So in other words, as soon as we come home, as soon as we get back to Jacob, and Jacob sees we don't have Benjamin with us, "as soon as I come to my father and the boy's not with us, then his life is bound up with the boy's life. As soon as he sees that the boy, Benjamin, is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol." Then the last verse, verse 34, "How can I go back to my father if the boy's not with me? I fear to see the evil, not that would find me, but I fear to see the evil that would find my father." Judah says, under no circumstances do I want to hurt my father. Under no circumstances am I going to do anything that would hurt him. Do you start to hear an echo of the words of Jesus when he was on this earth? What did Jesus say? "Everything my father's asked me to do, I'm going to do. Every will, every plan, every desire of his is what I'm going to carry out perfectly." We read in places like John 16 and John 17 where we see that Jesus wants to be with the Father, be glorified once again. He loves him. He says again and again, "You and I are one." And he can't wait to be one with him again, as it were. He loved his father and couldn't bear the thought of him hurting. And that brings us to number four out of our five, which this number four is by far the most important. This is the highlighted one, if you will. And the number four item on the list of positive things about Judah that help us understand about Jesus is that Judah is willing to be a substitute. Judah is willing to take the place of someone else, even when he doesn't need to. Look with me in chapter 44, verses 32 and 33 right here, where this is his plan. You know, the cup has been found in Benjamin's bag, and Benjamin's going to be kept as a slave. He says in verse 32, "Your servant, me, Judah, I became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life.'" So verse 33, "Now therefore, please let your servant, me, let me, Judah, remain here instead of the boy. Make me the slave instead of Benjamin. Let me take Benjamin's place. I know clearly, the circumstantial evidence is clearly, Benjamin's guilty and I'm innocent. Let me stay. Mistreat me. Let me be the slave and let Benjamin, the guilty one, go free. Take me instead of the boy. Let the boy go back with his brothers." He was willing to be a substitute when he didn't need to. Now think about all the tests. Well, first of all, notice this. You recall that before they left the home of their father Jacob to come to Egypt to get the food, remember the oldest son, Reuben, the one who's supposed to be the leader, the firstborn. If you look with me, go back to Genesis chapter 42, 37, and look at this grand, magnanimous offer that Reuben makes. Reuben says to his dad, Jacob, "Look, Dad, let us go to Egypt and get some food. We got to take Benjamin with us. The guy said he wouldn't give us any food if Benjamin doesn't go. So here's the deal I'll make with you, Dad. Let me take Benjamin with us to go get the food, and if Benjamin doesn't come back, I'll tell you what you can do. You can kill my two sons." That's the deal. "You kill my two sons if Benjamin doesn't come back, okay?" Jacob says, "No way. This boy is not going anywhere." Then time passes, and they get desperate again to where they desperately need some food. And this time, look at chapter 43, verses 8 and 9. And this is where Judah steps up. Because that offer by Reuben, that was pitiful. Here in chapter 43, verses 8 and 9, Judah says, "Take me. Benjamin doesn't come back, it's on me, on my life." He's not pointing the finger anywhere else, not saying my sons or my daughters or any other brother. He said, "It's on me if it doesn't happen." And so that's what starts this series of tests. We go back. Joseph tested them, number one, saying, "You're spies." He keeps Simeon back in order to try to bring Benjamin. Number two, and I want you to see test number two because this is crucial. Turn to chapter 43 and look at verse 34. 43:34. It's the very last verse in chapter 43. Joseph still hasn't revealed himself to the people. Remember, this is the second test. And he's got all the brothers lined up from the oldest to the youngest, from Reuben at the oldest to little Benjamin, the youngest there. And he's given them all their food. But notice what it says. Benjamin got 5 times more food than all the others. Now, do you think, oh, that's just no big deal. You kind of gloss over that, just keep reading. This is a huge test. Joseph, since he hasn't revealed himself, is giving the only other son to Rachel. Remember, she only had two, Joseph and Benjamin. And right now, Benjamin's the favorite. Back home, Jacob says, "This is my favorite now. Now that my other favorite's been taken, there's my new favorite." And so Joseph is watching to see, since I treat him special, what will all the others do? Will they show their envy of him? Will they show their hatred of him? Will they try and hurt him just the way they did me? It's a test. Are they still jealous of all of Rachel's boys? And then test number three was putting that silver cup into Benjamin's sack. Because there, as we read about it in chapter 44, verse 12, look at it, 44:12. They searched with the eldest, looked in his sack, found nothing, and moved down to the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Now think about it. Here's test number three. They can get off scot-free right now. If it's the case that they really are still jealous of Rachel's two boys, if they really can't stand the fact that Benjamin's now the favorite, they have the perfect out now. Cup's found with him. See ya. And again, they're saved. Because like before, sell Joseph and get money. It's a win-win situation. Again, get rid of Benjamin. We get to go back home. We're in a place of higher standing. Everything's great. So Joseph is standing back to see, what will you do? Do you still have that hatred? Do you still have that jealousy? Are you still vindictive? Or do you love each other now like you were supposed to? And here we see, by him being willing to be a substitute in chapter 44, we see that Judah chooses love. Judah chooses brotherhood. Judah is willing to give himself up for his brother. Now think about all the New Testament passages that come into play. Romans chapter 5, verse 7. One will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would even dare to die. But verse 8, but God shows his love for us that while we were yet sinners, while we were wicked, ugly, vile sinners, while we were his enemy, Christ died for us. John chapter 15, verse 13, greater love has no man than this, but that someone would lay down his life for his friends. See, the Bible says the greatest love someone can show is to purposely lay down his life for someone else. It's exactly what Judah does. Reuben wasn't willing to do it earlier. Judah is. And then 1 John chapter 3, verse 16, by this we know love. Here's how you and I can know what love really is. That he, Jesus the Christ, laid down his life for us. And then it goes on, and so we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. You see the way the New Testament keeps hammering that? How do you know if someone loves you? They're willing to die for you. How do we know Jesus loved us? Because while we were wicked sinners, his enemies, he died for us. So we come here, what's so special about Judah? He was willing to be a substitute. He was willing to take the place of a guilty one. Now, not really guilty, but it seemed guilty to all of them. They couldn't know. All those brothers had to think Benjamin was guilty. The cup's in his sack. And yet, without any questions, he says, take me instead. He's guilty. I'm innocent. Take me instead. Just like Jesus. You're all guilty. I'm innocent. Take me instead. So Judah is given the high praise in chapter 49. Judah is put in that special place in Matthew chapter 1, verse 2, because he was willing to give his life for someone else. It's the ultimate in what God is looking for. But then finally, fifthly and finally, we see that in being this substitute, in laying down his life for his brother, we see that Judah was pointing us in the direction of the ultimate substitute. Judah was pointing us in the direction. He was showing us the way, if you will, leading us to the greatest sacrifice. Look at chapter 46, verse 28. The imagery is going to be used here. 46:28. Jacob sent Judah ahead of him. Now, where's he going to go? He sent him ahead of him to Joseph to show the way before him into Goshen. Goshen, it says in chapter 47, verse 11, is the best of the land that the Pharaoh had to offer. So here's where Judah has come from. He's come from this man who's jealous, and he's a liar, and he's a hypocrite, he's immoral. And now he's the one who's showing everyone else the way to the good land. Now he's the one who's leading them. He's leading the charge into the best place. He was sent ahead to show the way to the best land. Does that not sound exactly like John chapter 14, where Jesus says, I'm going ahead in order that you can follow me? And then the questions are, well, how do we know? We don't know where to go. We don't know how to follow you. He says in John 14, 6, I'm the way, the truth, the life. And in essence, he's saying, so if you follow me, you find your way to the Father. No man comes to the Father but by me. I'm the one who'll show you the way to the best place, Jesus said. Just like Judah had done. So you see, when we put all these things together, we see we can learn what a man after God's own heart is. It's the one who's willing to admit his sin. And it's the man who's willing to say that I know who God is, I know what God does, I know what man can't do. And it's the one who loves his Father above all other things, just like Jesus the Christ did, and was willing to substitute himself for the guilty and show us the way to the best land. I want us to end with Revelation chapter 5. Turn there and we'll be done. Because remember, here's how we started. We started in Genesis 49, where Jacob is giving his blessing to Judah, and he says, you're the lion of the tribe of Judah. And he says, the scepter will not leave you. The kings will come from you. And then he goes on to say there in Genesis 49, he says that through you, there'll be the washing, there'll be the made new, right? And so we come over here to Revelation chapter 5. Look with me at verse 1, beginning of Revelation 5. I saw the light, or I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who's worthy to open the scroll and break its seals? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to even look into it. And I, John, began to weep loudly because there was no one found worthy to open the scroll or look into it. Verse 5, one of the elders said to me, weep no more. The lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David. See, he connects that just like in Matthew chapter 1. Judah leads to David, who leads to the Christ. The root of David has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain with seven horns, with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went and he took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense and the prayers of the saints. And they sing a new song. Notice what they sing. Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals. You were slain. And I want you to notice this and how it connects back to the promise, the blessing given to Judah in Genesis 49. By your blood, you ransomed people for God. Every tribe and language and people and nation, you've made them a kingdom and priest to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. Is that not exactly what Jacob said would happen through Judah? Kings will come from you. People will be cleansed through you. They'll be made new through you, because it's through you that the king is coming. And we see that very thing happening here. They say to the lamb, it's by your blood that people are brought back to God. It's by you that people get to become a kingdom of priests. It's by you, the lion of the tribe of Judah. I hope that you see here, as we've gone through this once again, that to truly understand a book like Revelation, to truly understand who Jesus is, what it means for him to be the lion of the tribe of Judah, to be the root of Jesse, for what that means for Jesus, we have to go all the way back to Genesis and recognize and see the things that Judah did, understand the blessing that Jacob gave to Judah, and now we can know who this lion is. Now we can know what it means to be the lion of the tribe of Judah. And now the question is this, do we belong to that tribe? Have we been washed in the blood that puts us in that surrounding of being a kingdom of priests, just like they talked about? Have we been washed by the blood that it said there in Revelation 5 makes us brand new, redeemed and brought back to God? Well, the offer is yours. As we see from all the way from Judah to Jesus, the offer is to be washed in his blood and be made into a kingdom of priests. If there's any way that we can help you tonight, we hope that you will come to the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Make your needs known while we stand and sing.
What can make